Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the council session to order. Welcome to Kansas City. I hope you're all enjoying the hotel and the area. Lots of interesting things. Kansas City's a great town. As usual, for these things, I want to begin with some announcements and then sort of get us to do some exercises to warm us up. Get our brains going, perhaps, or at least our bodies going. Just to remind folks, today at lunch is the regional selective lunch. It has been expanded to 2 hours at the request of both selective and regionals, and I think that should give you a good chance to get together with your regional, or if your regional is not here, find a group and get together with them. Check the message board outside. Most lunch plans are announced on there. I do have one announcement. That's the Maryland, Delaware, Washington, D.C. folks will meet at the registration desk at noon. So, okay. Certificates. Continuing ed certificates are going to be available in the break room. They're going to be available earlier than usual. We usually put them out a little bit later. So if you're, now they had to, did they have to apply this time for those? I don't remember. Yeah. But those are available. Also, if during the course of the meeting, if you have a question, and you're at the mic, please speak loudly and tell us your name and your affiliation because these proceedings are being recorded. And I've already violated that rule by not introducing myself. My name's Jeff Swindells. I'm the chair of the Depository Library Council this year, and I'm at Northwestern University. What I'd like to do is go around the council table and just have council members introduce themselves. And then we'll proceed to do some calisthenics. I guess we could start with Katrina.
Katrina Steerholtz at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis.
Kathy Lahan, San Francisco Public Library.
Tim Byrne, Department of Energy, Office of Scientific and Technical Information.
Tori Trotta, Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, Arizona State University.
Peter Hemphill of Hemphill & Associates, an IT consulting firm.
I'm Rick Davis. I'm the Acting Superintendent of Documents and the Director of Library Services at the U.S. Government Printing Office.
Bob Tapella, I'm the Public Printer.
Chris Greer, I'm with the Office of Science and Technology Policy and the Program for Networking and Information Technology Research and Development.
Mark Sandler, I'm the Director of the Center for Library Initiatives at the Committee on Institutional Cooperation.
I'm Denise Stevens, Vice Provost and Chief Information Officer at the University of Kansas.
I'm Denise Davis. I direct the Office for Research and Statistics for the American Library Association.
Ken Wiggins, State Librarian, Connecticut.
Gwen Sinclair, University of Hawaii at Manoa.
John Schuler, University of Illinois at Chicago.
We're now going to do some calisthenics. First, we're going to get a sense of geography here. If you are from east of the Mississippi, would you stand? Wow, you've all crossed the river. If you are from west of the Mississippi, could you stand? If you are from islands off the coast, from far away, could you stand? We should have a few. Gwen's the only one? Okay. Okay, library types. I'd like to get a sense of public libraries out there. How many of you in public libraries? I'd like to give a big round of applause to our public library participants. Law libraries. state libraries. Wow. Good representation. Any federal libraries out there? There we go. And I hate to ask this, but academic libraries, are there any here? Okay, and we always do funding. How many people here are here with the full funding of their institution? Wow. There's a commitment from the institutions. How many people with partial funding from their institutions? And now these are the people we really need to give a round of applause to. How many people are paying their own way? And finally, how many folks are new attendees? How many folks, this is their first Depository Library Conference? Welcome. Okay, I think we look forward to a very good conference. I want to urge you to, if you have any questions that you don't want to ask in public, that you grab a member of council and talk to us about anything that concerns you, that upsets you, that you think is wonderful, that you'd like to alert us to, and we can work with you and help you advertise the things that are wonderful and perhaps help fix some of the things that aren't so wonderful. And you'll see us walking around. We have these little blue things that say council member. Plus, you should all recognize us after a couple days. And we do have coffee with council in the mornings, but don't feel that's the only time you can get in touch with us. We're available whenever you see us, so take advantage of that. Without further ado, I would like to introduce the public printer of the United States, the Honorable Robert C. Tappella.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, following Jeff's rules, my name is Bob Tappella, and I'm the public printer of the United States for the transcribers. As I look around the table at council and out in the audience, I see a lot of old friends, a few new faces. I appreciate all of you coming to Kansas City today. I don't know about you, but I think this hotel has been great so far. I arrived yesterday. Their hospitality has been wonderful. And for those that are putting on this session or this meeting, I commend you. You've done a great job. I'm particularly impressed with the books. You guys did a great job. And just so you know, the information got to council, what was it, 3 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago. So there's no excuse for them not being prepared. Although I understand at least one member mentioned that they hadn't read anything yet and were going to be cramming last night. Almost as red as her suit. No. You know, when I met with council in October, I said that I wanted a healthy, productive partnership with the library community. I said that we'd get there by increasing effective communications, raising our level of services, and enabling more transparency in GPO's work with the community. In the past 6 months, I believe we've been doing just that, and the book is just one more example of it. I'm pleased to report that GPO has recorded net income for the fourth consecutive year. We increased overall revenues to levels that have not been experienced at GPO for more than a decade, primarily as the result of the production of electronic passports, as well as other in-plant operations. Efforts to economize and increase efficiency also contributed measurably to the financial results. Earlier this month, I appeared before the House Legislative Branch Appropriations Subcommittee. For fiscal year 2009, GPO is requesting a total of $174,354,000, which will enable GPO to, one, meet projected requirements for GPO's congressional printing and binding operation, as well as information dissemination during fiscal year 2009. Recover the shortfall in the congressional printing and binding appropriation accumulated in fiscal year 2007 and projected for fiscal year 2008. Provide investment funds for necessary information dissemination projects in the Federal Depository Library Program. Complete the initial release of FDSIS, GPO's federal digital system, and continue development of systems enhancements along with other improvements to GPO's information technology infrastructure. And finally, perform essential building maintenance and repairs to our aged factory. Technology is at the center of GPO's operations today. GPO's Federal Digital System, FDSIS, is the backbone. Of the total funding investments requested by GPO, nearly half are directly related to the establishment and operation of GPO's FDSIS. This includes modernizing congressional publishing, replacing production workflow systems, and digitizing the FDLP legacy collection. The salaries and expenses appropriation for the superintendent of documents. The program increases for the S&E appropriation request for fiscal year 2009 are required to cover mandatory pay and price level increases, as well as projects that are all directly linked to FDSIS. I know Rick will be talking more specifically about our request and some of the programs in his talk, but what I told Congress and what I believe based on what I've seen so far, these projects are all geared to ensure the broadest access possible to federal government information and the highest level of service to the American public. The building project, something GPO has been talking about for a number of years. GPO needs a modern and efficient facility. I'd like it to have green building certification. I've begun working with our oversight committees on a new plan, a plan that would, one, require no direct appropriations, two, allow us to remain on our current site, three, maintain current employee headcounts, four, provide additional space for legislative branch, and five, not face an untenable CBO score. I believe we could have legislation passed this year to make the new building a reality. GPO is successful today, and I'd like to specifically address the success of our security and intelligent documents business. It's profitable. Some are suggesting too profitable. I'm not certain yet. Because of the unprecedented demand for passports last year and the prudent increases in passport inventory so far this year, GPO is experiencing accelerated revenue recognition, not necessarily excess profits. GPO is unlike most other federal agencies in that all GPO activities are financed through a business-like revolving fund. The revolving fund functions as GPO's checking account with the United States Treasury. The fund is used to pay all of GPO's costs, and the fund is reimbursed by our agency customers when they pay invoices. It is also reimbursed by our two appropriations, Congressional Printing and Binding and the S&E appropriation. The price we charge State Department for blank books is negotiated with the State Department. It's based on our estimated production costs plus reserves for capital projects, apportioned out over an estimated quantity of books produced. There are 66 different line items used to price the United States passport, and we periodically review our pricing with the State Department. We bill the State Department for actual passports produced. Not all of the expenses included in the price we charge the State Department for passports are booked at the same time as the revenue. Because of our business type accrual accounting system, the expenses are not recognized until the investment has been placed into service. There's a timing distance. Revenue first, then expenses, and not necessarily in the same year. When I met with you in October, I asked for input on the qualities needed for the next SUDOCs. Then in December, I met with representatives from ALA, SLA, GODORT, AALL, ARL, and the chair of the Depository Library Council. We had a rather candid, and in some cases spirited, discussion to validate the findings. I truly appreciate the willingness of all of you who participated. I have not yet identified the right candidate for SUDOCS, and I won't rush the process. I promised that to you in October. I again promise that in December. I believe the program is in the capable hands of Rick Davis, serving in his role as acting SUDOCS, and I hope you share my view. FDCIS. FDCIS is the highest priority program at GPO and central to our transformation. Mike Walsh and I have worked very closely on FDCIS for many years. We continuously monitor progress. Late last year, we conducted a detailed program review, just like I've done with every other key initiative at the agency. After the FDCIS review, Mike recommended a radical change to our approach, to move away from the master integrator-based solution that we embarked on in 2006. After careful consideration of the consequences of this change, I accepted his recommendation. Program changes were started earlier this year. Mike will further outline the background leading up to this recommendation in the afternoon session. The biggest change is that GPO is now taking full responsibility for all program management. Harris will do only the software development. This change shifts more responsibility and risk to GPO. But I'm confident with the team we have assembled, this will produce FDCIS on time and on budget. Celine DeLucky, where are you? Stand up, please. You all know Celine, right? I'm pleased to announce that Celine has been named the program manager of FDCIS. It is critical. It is critical to have a, keep standing, face your adoring audience. It's critical to have a strong program manager assigned to this task now that we're taking on greater responsibility. Celine's extensive agency and library program experience, her demonstrated strength and leadership in program management makes her the ideal person to manage this complex project to a successful launch. At the fall meeting, we discussed changes in the CIO organization. Wait, you're still sitting down? Back up, Celine. Celine will have the full support of Mike Walsh and all of the resources within IT to successfully launch FDCIS. You'll hear more details from Celine regarding the FDCIS program changes and plans during the afternoon session as well. Okay, now you can sit down. GPO has been the topic of a couple of articles by the Washington Times this past week. And other media outlets have picked up on the stories, and I know it's been moving through the blogosphere. Much of the information presented in the articles was presented out of context and was grossly inaccurate. And quite frankly, this series of stories constituted irresponsible journalism, something you'd expect from the National Enquirer. I'd like to address some of the specific questions the article may have raised for any of you here in the audience. Question: are passports really made overseas? Do we send blank passports overseas? Answer: no. We manufacture the passport books at GPO in Washington, D.C., and soon we will be producing them in Stennis, Mississippi as well. Some of the components are from overseas, including the chip and the antenna. We would like to use all U.S.-made components, and we're working with our vendors to move in this direction. However, it's important to note that all of our vendors, whether in the United States or overseas, have met GPO's, the State Department's, and the U.S. intelligence community's security standards. Question: did we really make $100 million in profit, and are we gouging the State Department? Answer: no. All of the money we've earned in the last year is already earmarked for current and future programs related to the e-passport program, such as the secure production facility in Stennis, Mississippi. However, due to the way we're required to maintain our financial records, we may show income on the books without linking it to future budgeted projects. So if someone looks at our financial statement at a time When we have not spent the money, it may appear we have profit. You know, it's like when you get your paycheck each month. You may show the full amount in the bank on that first day, but you know it's already spent on the mortgage and credit cards and telephone bills and whatever else you have. We establish the price we charge with the State Department, their full approval, and their full participation in the pricing. The State Department wanted us to ensure that we could not only meet the increased demand for passports, but that we also had a backup passport production facility well outside of Washington, D.C. So we incorporated the costs necessary for those investments in the price we charge for the passport. Question: was Stennis, Mississippi a good location for the secure production facility? Answer: yes. There are many reasons why Stennis was the best choice, including Stennis offered an already established, highly secured government campus, so our startup time was significantly reduced and our initial expenses were lower. Second, as we all know, Mississippi was hit hard by Hurricane Katrina. The federal government has been committed to helping our fellow citizens in this area as much as possible. By locating our facility at Stennis, we are able to contribute to the area's economic recovery. And finally, Stennis proved itself to be very hurricane safe. It was one of the locations where people evacuated to, and there was almost no damage from Katrina to any of the facilities on the Stennis campus. Question: are GPO senior leaders doing extravagant travel? Answer: no. First of all of the GPO travel noted in the articles was for GPO business purposes. Because we are involved in producing passports that will be used worldwide, we have to coordinate with many other governments on technology and compatibility. Also, all GPO travel follow GSA requirements in regard to cost. Question: did GPO give out all of those bonuses? Answer: yes. GPO has been rolling out a bonus program that started first with senior managers, then moved to all managers. The plan has been to expand this program to all employees next year, pending negotiations with our unions. GPO modeled our program based on the Government Accountability Office's guidelines. In reality, GPO senior manager bonuses are significantly lower than the average government agency bonus given to executives in executive branch agencies. And now my favorite. Did we really spend $10,000 on a portrait of the public printer? No. We did, however, hire a photographer off the GSA schedule following standard procurement procedures. This photographer took many photos of several different events, and these photos are being used for many different purposes. This included the official portrait of the public printer. As you know, GPO is a multifaceted organization involved in many different types of work. We operate on a revolving fund rather than an annual appropriation. As such, it's hard for people outside GPO to understand what we do and how we do it, especially since much of our work is confidential. The Washington Times has done a real disservice to our employees by implying that we're not following government rules and that we would do anything to risk the security of our nation's most important document, the United States passport. GPO has a proud history, and GPO will continue to put forward the facts, and we'd appreciate your support. This concludes my formal remarks, but I'd like to preface what's next. Right after I arrived at GPO, a little over five years ago, I was asked to give the keynote address at the On Demand Printing and Publishing Conference in New York City. My topic was the transformation of GPO that we were embarking upon, and nearly half of my talk was about the proud history of GPO and what we do. Being a little bit of a showman, and quite frankly, being nervous about facing several thousand people in the audience, I delivered my talk with a multimedia show going on behind me and around me. I don't know if my speech was a success, but the audience was very impressed with the multimedia show. What you're about to view is a video created by GPO after that speech. It's shown every day in the GPO Visitor Center. It's significantly shorter than my speech, however. I think it only lasts 7 minutes. I thought you might enjoy learning a little bit more about GPO's 147 years of service to this nation. And now I'm told I get to cue up the video. ¶¶
On March 4th, 1861, there were two inaugurations in Washington, D.C. Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as the 16th President of the United States, and the U.S. Government Printing Office opened for business. GPO set up shop in a printing plant originally built by Cornelius Wendell, a longtime contract printer for Congress. Congress purchased the building at the corner of North Capitol and H Streets for $135,000. It was the largest printing plant in Washington and one of the largest in the United States. The first head of GPO was John D. DeFries, an Illinois newspaper publisher, politician, and friend of President Lincoln. As the nation plunged into civil war, GPO grew rapidly to keep pace with printing needs, military and civilian alike. In 1864, GPO employees participated more directly in the war when Company F of the Interior Department Regiment, composed of GPO printers and pressmen, marched into Northwest Washington to help repel Confederate forces under General Jubal Early at the climax of his raid on the Capitol. After the war, GPO continued to expand along with the nation. In 1866, GPO purchased a Bullock press, an example of the cutting-edge printing technology of its day. Installation of the Bullock was GPO's first step in a series of technological changes that vastly expanded the volume and quality of its printing work. In 1876, the head of GPO became, by law, the public printer. The law also specified that the public printer be a practical printer and versed in the art of bookbinding. Another major milestone in GPO history was the Printing Act of 1895, which made GPO responsible for the printing of all three branches of the federal government, and for the dissemination of government publications for sale and for deposit in congressionally designated libraries nationwide. As the 20th century dawned, GPO began to take on its present-day appearance with the construction of Building 1, which opened for business in 1903. In 1904, machine typesetting revolutionized government printing with the arrival of linotype and monotype at GPO. These two amazing machines shifted the formula for typesetting from minutes per line to lines per minute. GPO typesetters became among the most skillful in the world. A spelling revolution hit GPO in 1906 when President Theodore Roosevelt instructed public printer Charles Stillings to adopt simplified spelling for 300 common English words as recommended by a distinguished panel of language experts commissioned by Andrew Carnegie. The spelling of THRU for through and FIXT for fixed immediately drew the wrath and ridicule of citizens and newspapers across the country, and Congress terminated the experiment by the end of the year. A more widely accepted change occurred in 1910, when horse-drawn wagons were replaced by horseless carriages for deliveries to Capitol Hill. In 1917, America entered the First World War. With imported printing supplies falling victim to German U-boats and British blockades, GPO began making its own ink and marbled paper and expanded its recycling of type metal. The first years of the 20th century were all about expansion at GPO. As the government's demand for printing grew, so did production and the number of GPO employees. This large, dedicated workforce gained the ability to bargain as a result of the Keese Act of 1924, the beginning of a unique and ongoing partnership with GPO management. Under public printer George Carter, an increased focus on employees and their need for additional space brought about a new employee-managed cafeteria, recreational activities, including a duckpin bowling alley, a shuffleboard court, and a modern auditorium named for President Warren G. Harding, known as the printer president because of his background in newspaper work. An employee orchestra serenaded during lunch hours with popular hits of the day, and many sports teams and clubs flourished, providing a break from the often arduous schedule of the big shop. The Great Depression hit America and GPO hard, but an enormous volume of printing for FDR's New Deal soon had the presses humming. GPO's apprentice training program really came into its own, providing employment for printing apprentices, men and women alike. In 1935, Congress authorized two new buildings. Building 3, replacing the original GPO building at North Capitol and H Streets, and Building 4, a paper warehouse adjacent to Union Station, for deliveries of paper and other supplies by rail. When Building 3 opened in 1940, GPO assumed the physical appearance it retains today. From 1941 to 1945, GPO joined the worldwide crusade against the Axis, driving its production of printing to new heights and keeping employee morale high with Saturday dances in Harding Hall and other recreational activities. In post-war America, GPO accelerated its use of commercial contracting. No single plant, even one as huge as GPO, could keep pace with the tremendous growth of government programs at the onset of the Cold War. In 1967, GPO began the transition from linotype to linotron. It was GPO's first venture into computer typesetting. Although the change to photocomposition caused labor strife in other printing enterprises, GPO management and employees worked together to ensure a smooth transition. By 1983, the era of machine typesetting at GPO was at an end. The stage was set for a new era, resulting in tremendous savings to GPO customers and dramatically cutting the cost of congressional printing. Since the early 1990s, GPO's award-winning website, one of the few government sites authorized by law, has been one of the government's largest and most heavily used, serving all three branches of government and the public. It has also expanded free public access through GPO's Federal Depository Library Program. GPO's printing procurement program continues to be one of the government's longest-running partnerships with the private sector, saving millions of taxpayer dollars per year and creating jobs and tax revenues in states and localities nationwide. Today, the presses continue to run, even as the U.S. Government Printing Office continues to transform itself with the latest developments in information technology as we move beyond ink and paper.